This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
So, I was thinking of what to say when I show this first slide, other than soon you'll be able to drink wine, of course. Secondly, I as I was walking up, I started to remember an old ad. I don't know if you remember, Orson Welles used to drink those glass of wine and say that it wasn't released before its time. That was way, way back. Believe it or not, Belatacept was not released before its time. It took forever. I mean, actually, this is a problem that we have, that clinical trial takes forever. We started clinical trials with Belatacept in 2000. But in fact, the parent compound was developed in 1992. So it just gives you an idea from bench to the clinic that it's almost a 20-year type of affair. And with the cost of running clinical trials, it's amazing that, frankly, drug companies continue to develop drugs because the regulatory process has become so challenging and so difficult. Well, that's not... So, why is... So, Belatacept was approved for use in June of 2011. And so issue is, how do we use it, where it's best used, and so on. So I think in the past we have discussed the mechanism of action of Belatacept and why it's such an important pathway to inhibit. That's because the T cells, to become activated, requires two signals. One signal is the delivery of antigen to the T cell receptor of the T cells, but this determines the specificity of the alloimmune response. The second signal, the one that truly activates the T cell, is a costimulatory signal, and that's when CD28 binds first to CD86, then to CD80, the T cell becomes activated, proliferates, produces cytokines, and of course, what follows will be an episode of clinical rejection. If you don't get costimulatory signals and the T cell sees only antigen, it becomes allergic and develops and undergoes apoptosis. And in small animals, in fact, if you block co-stimulation, you can induce tolerance. And that was the powerful bench studies that drove the clinical development of co-stimulatory blockade. And so there were many efforts to block co-stimulation, but it's nature itself that gave us a clue possibly how best to block it. And that's because the T cells, when it becomes activated, it upregulates a second receptor similar to CD28, except this receptor has better affinity to the two ligands, CD80-86, so it displaces CD28. And unlike CD28, the CTLA4 receptor transduces negative signal to the T cell, stops the T cell activation, and the T cell then undergoes apoptosis. So it became apparent that the CTLA4 molecule could be used for therapeutic purposes. And so in the very early 90s, Bristol-Myers developed CTLA4-Ig, which was the extracellular domain of CTLA4, bound to the Fc portion of IgG1 to give it longer half-life. And in vitro, as well in experimental animals, CTLA4-Ig was a powerful immunosuppressant. However, when used in primates for organ transplant, it wasn't as powerful. And part of the reason was that its affinity to CD86 was not very good. And so it got improved with a second generation molecule, which became Belatacept. The first generation CTLA4-Ig is approved for use in rheumatoid arthritis, and there's a molecule that is being developed for other autoimmune diseases. Why the second generation with better binding characteristics to the two ligands, belatacept, was developed for kidney transplantation. And in the past, I have presented data from the two trials that were the two phase three trials that actually finally won the approval for the drug. One trial called Benefit, and this enrolled in this study patients who received kidneys from standard criteria donors or living donors were enrolled, while the second trial, Benefit X, enrolled only recipients who received what we used to call marginal kidneys, and now we prefer to refer to them as extended criteria donors. It sounds better. So the protocol for both studies was basically the same. There were three arms. The comparator arm received cyclosporin. The two belatacept arm were CNI-free, no cyclosporin. There was a more intensive regimen and a less intense regimen. Basically, the difference between the two regimen occurred between months 1 and 6. The more intense received more frequent administration of the higher dose medication at more frequent intervals. Beyond 6 months, the more intense and the lower intensity regimen received basically the same dosage, 5 milligrams per kilo, every 4 weeks intravenously. And so now I want to go over the three-year results to show you what has happened at 3 years with the two studies. So these are the patients that were followed at 3 years. The majority were followed, actually. There was a pretty good follow-up in this study. The patients surviving with functioning graft at 3 years, these are the belatacept-treated patients versus cyclosporin. This is not statistically significant. I have to point out that most of our interest is the belatacept lower intensity regimen because that's a regimen that was approved for use by the FDA. Now, at rejection rates at 3 years, as you've heard mentioned before, that rejections with belatacept were higher than with cyclosporin. So at 3 years, you can see that belatacept lower intensity regimen, the approved regimen, 17% compared to 10% for cyclosporin. The more intense regimen actually gave a higher rejection rate of 24%. There may be other reasons why more immunosuppression with belatacept may not be that good. And so this is one of the many reasons why the lower intensity regimen was approved by the FDA for use. Now, the most important issue with the three-year data is what happened to the GFR. So the GFR of patients on belatacept right away after transplant was significantly higher than patients treated with cyclosporin. As you can see, the delta GFR was about 15 ml. At 2 years, it was 17 ml, and by 3 years, it went up to 21 ml. But as importantly, if you look at the slope of the creatinine, cyclosporin, as with many other CNI, they have a negative slope. So on average, you may lose about 2 ml per year. With the belatacept-treated patient, you can see that the slope has become positive. So at 3 years, the bela-treated patients not only have a higher GFR, but their slope is going positive. So the function of these kidneys, one can predict, will last longer. Now, this is a percentage of patients that have a poor outcome, meaning GFR less than 30, graft loss or death. And this is expressed as a probability of surviving free of these three endpoints. And as you can see, a higher percentage of patients treated with the two arms Bella achieved this endpoint free of having a bad GFR, graft loss or death as compared with cyclosporin. Now, Dr. Schnitzler, using data from the registry, has a risk predictive model that can predict what happens to kidneys over the long term. And using that model and based on the GFR at 3 years, rejection rates, as well as the donor characteristics, projected that patients who were treated with the lower intensity regimen would have about a half-life 2 years greater than patients who were treated with the CNI. Now, this is again projected survival based on 3-year data. This is a second study, the Benefit X. Again, as I said, this is the extended criteria study. Again, there was better GFR in the patient, a better survival, but this is not statistically significant as compared to patients treated with cyclosporin. This is just numerical difference. Rejection rates were again slightly higher. The issue with the rejection rate is not that there weren't, you know, statistically significant between LI and the cyclosporin, but interestingly, when they occurred, they were histologically more severe. They were not antibody-mediated rejection; they were cellular rejection. But the histology of these rejection was more severe. The GFR again of the two belatacept-treated patients was, as in the previous study, significantly better than the patients treated with cyclosporin. As you can see, the GFR of these patients is lower than what we had seen with the Benefit study, and that's because these are, again, kidneys from extended criteria donors. So these kidneys are either from donors who are over 60 or those between age 50 to 60 who had hypertension, a death from CVA, or a terminal creatinine greater than 5. 2 out of 3 would be the criteria required to satisfy for ECD. And again, in terms of the bad endpoints here, a significantly higher percentage of patients treated with cyclosporin reached the endpoint of GFR less than 30, graft loss or death, as compared to the Bela patients. Now, again, comparing using the predictive model of Schnitler to be able to predict graft half-life, the patients on belatacept had achieved the graft half-life approximately 2 years greater than those on cyclosporin. Now, you have to realize that the graft half-life, the numbers of years it takes to lose half of the graft, in patients who receive ECD kidneys, about 5 and a half years. So adding 2 years, that's a significant increase in graft half-life. Of course, these are predictive models, and these are not actual increase in graft half-life. Now, in terms of safety, these are the population of patients that were analyzed. So we put the two studies together, the Benefit and the Benefit X. So as you can see, in terms of time to death through 3 years, comparing Benefit, pooling the data of the two trials, comparing belatacept versus cyclosporin, you can see that the lower dose belatacept had delay onset of graft and lower than either cyclosporin or the more intense regimen of belatacept. Now, the patients on the lower intensity regimen had lower death than either of the other two groups, higher dose belatacept or cyclosporin, predominantly because of a decrease of death due to infectious complications. The infection that stood out the greatest, actually, by 3 years was, in fact, TB. There were 6 cases in each of the belatacept arm as compared to cyclosporin, 1 case. And all these from endemic areas occurred, patients in clinical trials in Brazil and India. So I think getting a proper history of TB, patients who may have had a positive BPD not treated, that's something that needs to be taken into account before considering therapy for with belatacept. And again, the same thing, time to serious infection. The patients treated with the lower intensity regimen, lower and later as compared to the more intense regimen or cyclosporin. And so you can understand why the FDA, looking at the efficacy and the safety, that they approved the lower intense regimen. Now, one of the major issues with belatacept that became apparent with the phase 3 trials, that there were many more cases of PTLD in the belatacept-treated patients, 5-year, and 1 in the patients treated with cyclosporin. And when we looked at the data of all the studies, the phase 2 initial study as well as the 2 phase 3, there were 8 cases in the more intense in the first 3 years, 7 in the lower intensity regimen, and 3 in cyclosporin. I think what was also disconcerting was that many of these PTLD in the belatacept-treated patients, especially the MI, the more intense regimen, were CNS. And CNS PTLD is invariably fatal. Now, the risk factor became quite apparent when we analyzed PTLD vis-a-vis EBV status. As you can see, based on EBV status, the risk of patients who are EBV negative and receive belatacept, 8.8% develop PTLD. On the other, if they were EBV positive, the risk was down to 0.74. There was a similar, but obviously the magnitude much lower, higher PTLD rate in cyclosporin who were EBV negative. And as you can see here, that the risk for CNS PTLD, again, concentrated in patients who were EBV negative. And so when the FDA approved for the use of belatacept, not only was it with the lower regimen, but the patients have to be known to be EBV positive. Obviously, if you're EBV negative and you get exposed to EBV and you get belatacept therapy and costimulation blockade, then you're at much higher risk of developing a PTLD. Now, what other outcomes can be analyzed from the phase 3 data? This is a study on pre-transplant diabetics and how do they fare with CNI and belatacept. So this is data that is analyzed from the phase 3 studies. So in terms of the benefit group, the patients who receive standard kidneys, the diabetic patients who were on belatacept, their survival rate was in the 90% compared to 86% on cyclosporin. In the benefit X, the patient survival was lower. As you can expect, these are older people. Patients surviving with a functioning kidney, 77% in the lower intensity compared to 67% in patients treated with cyclosporin. There were more dramatic differences, however, even with the GFR in the benefit trial. The GFR of patients on belatacept with a lower intensity was 65 ml per minute, down to 42 in patients treated with cyclosporin. In those who received extended criteria donor kidneys who were diabetic, GFR with belatacept was 39 compared to 23 in patients who were treated with cyclosporin. So an extended criteria kidney that goes into diabetic patient who is on CNI, I think they start by having a CKD pretty well advanced. Now, one of the interesting findings from the phase 3 trials was the fact that patients on belatacept had a lower occurrence of donor-specific antibodies. So despite slightly higher rejection rate in patients treated with belatacept, and the fact that, in fact, when these rejections occurred, histologically they were more severe, that these patients, the belatacept-treated patients, tended to have a lower incidence of donor-specific transfusion, 3% for belatacept compared to 8% for patients treated with cyclosporin. Now, there has been a number of studies showing if you have a rejection and you don't develop donor-specific antibodies, your outcome is similar to patients who don't have a rejection. On the other hand, the outcome becomes much worse if following the acute rejection, the patient developed donor-specific antibodies. And there is good reason why these patients do not develop DSA, I mean, in terms of basic research. These are studies in primates. Primates treated with belatacept or placebo, they were immunized with sheep red blood cells. And you can see that patients, placebo, have a big humoral response, a large humoral response. On the other hand, belatacept-treated patients do not have a humoral response. So although belatacept does not directly affect plasma cells or B cells, at least presumably, it does indirectly affect them through T help to B cells or through the a cytokine mediation. And therefore, we see that this effect can be shown experimentally as well as in humans. And these are studies in primates transplant, again, showing that unlike patients treated with conventional immunosuppression, patients treated with belatacept do not develop anti-donor antibodies. And we know that anti-donor antibodies, when they develop, have a bad prognostication. This is, again, a large study from Terasaki analyzing patients who post-transplant develop HLA antibodies versus those who did not. And a year later, the 2 years later, the graft loss in patients who develop antibodies was twice as high as in those patients who did not develop antibodies. This is independent whether they had rejection or not. So the summary of the phase 3 trial was that the lower intensity regimen had better overall safety than MI and is a recommended registered regimen. The risk of PTLD is minimized by first using, of course, the lower intensity regimen. Number two, selecting only patients with who are known to be EBV positive. And then knowing that these patients don't develop donor-specific antibodies following rejection, to try to reverse rejection initially with steroids rather than with the depleting agents. Now, the phase 2 and phase 3 study used induction with Simulect or basiliximab and used a maintenance regimen of belatacept, MMF, and steroids. And so the question is, can you further... So these phase 3 studies basically eliminated CNI. But the issue is, can you eliminate CNI and steroids? We tend to associate, and our patients also don't like steroids, but we tend to associate that CNI and steroids are the ones that give the greatest number of toxicities to the patients. So this study was performed, and this is a small study, was performed to determine whether, in fact, not only eliminating CNI from a regimen with belatacept, but if you avoid steroids, can you have a good outcome? And so about 90 patients were randomized into three groups. They all received induction here, different than the phase 3. They received induction with thymoglobulin, so they were being depleted at the beginning. The two belatacept-treated patients, treated arms, one group received maintenance with MMF, the other one with sirolimus. And the comparator arm received thymoglobulin and maintenance with tacrolimus and MMF. All three groups were withdrawn from steroids at day 5. So the thymoglobulin patients were on tacrolimus MMF, and the two belatacept-treated patients were either on sirolimus or on MMF. So all of them were steroid-free. And the rejection rates were low in all three groups, 3% the TAC-MMF, and the two belatacept-treated groups, a range of 4 to 12%. The GFR, again, in the patients treated with belatacept was better than patients treated with tacrolimus, as you would expect that. One of the major criticisms of the phase 3 trials was that the comparator arm used cyclosporin. And as you know from all the patients that come to you after transplantation, the overall majority are treated with tacrolimus. And so some critics have complained that you really could not compare outcomes because you're not using a regimen that is now basically the standard of care, which is a valid criticism. But, you know, when you look at data differences between cyclosporin and tacrolimus, the outcomes between the two are not that great. It's clear, though, that cyclosporin may produce more vasoconstriction than tacrolimus. I think in terms of ultimate nephrotoxicity, there is no evidence that one is less nephrotoxic than the other. And this study shows, again, that, you know, with Bela, you get, again, about 8 to 10 ml per minute difference in GFR as compared to tacrolimus. Now, the tacrolimus-treated patients, 90% plus at 1 year were off steroids, while only 3/4 of patients treated with belatacept were off steroids. But the belatacept arms were also off CNI. So I think this protocol shows that you can have a CNI-free regimen, and in 3/4 of patients at 1 year, you can have them steroid-free. So this was a pilot study. I think larger trials are planned with this regimen, but this ultimately may be a very appealing regimen if it's shown to work in a larger group of patients. Alison Weber earlier showed you the outcome of patients treated who were switched from CNI to belatacept, showing that on average by 2 years, these patients gained about 8 ml per minute of GFR. Now, these differences may sound not that impressive, but actually, other than statistically, whether they're significant or not, they're clinically relevant. As I said, on average, patients will lose 2 ml per minute per year. So having an increment of 8 ml per minute can prolong the graft for several years. Is belatacept monotherapy a viable option? You know, ultimately, I'd like to see more patients withdrawn from all therapies other than remaining on belatacept. This is a patient who was part of an ITN trial. We gave the patient an anti-IL-2 antibody, at that point, daclizumab, 4 days of steroids, a year of sirolimus, and belatacept. And then at 1 year, the patient was on just sirolimus and belatacept. We did a biopsy. The kidney was normal. The patient did not develop those specific antibodies. And so we stopped sirolimus. And now it's over 3 years that the patient is on monotherapy with a creatinine of 0.9. So this patient, every 4 weeks, comes in or goes to the local infusion center, gets the infusion, and goes home. So I don't think belatacept is a perfect drug. I think, there are issues. But at least if you look at the phase 3 data over 3 years, you have less hyperlipidemia, less hypertension, less new onset diabetes, and better GFR. Now, you have to be able to accept those benefits vis-a-vis possibly a slightly higher rejection at the beginning. I think the PTLD risk has to be mitigated by selection of patients, and you need to make sure that the patient is actually EBV positive. So what are the challenges facing belatacept? The cost, about $925 or so for 250 milligram amps. As I said, the chronic dose is 5 milligram per kilo. So for a year, it comes just under $25,000. Of course, you have to infuse it, so the hassles, you have to find an infusion center. Now, Bristol-Myers has a whole network where you go call an 800 number and they find you the infusion center, etc. But it's different than writing a prescription for, like, tacrolimus. It's an effort that you have to make. The one issue about the intravenous administration is that you know about your patient being compliant. In recent studies from the DCAF group, actually, shows that 20% of patients who lose their kidneys or have bad rejection long term is due to non-adherence, non-compliance. We know from the clinical trials, we had the patients who were not very compliant, but if they did not show up, we knew that, and we would call them. And I had a couple of patients who were in the trial who stopped their steroids, weren't taking their CellCept, but we knew, at least in terms of the belatacept, were they getting it or whether they were not getting it. And if they didn't show for the administration, and the network that Bristol-Myers has set up will inform the physician whether the patient has shown up to the infusion center or not. And the REMS, it's a big hassle. Basically, this is a risk evaluation and mitigation strategy. There is one in place. The FDA puts it for the transplant centers. We have to report every 6 months that the patient is doing all right. Have they lost their kidneys? Have they died? Or have they developed PTLD? And this is because there was an increased PTLD initially with the phase 3 trials. So why do we need to hassle with new drugs? I mean, I think you all see the patients coming back from transplantation. They're on TAC, MMF or Myfortic. Some are on prednisone, others are on prednisone. And they seem to do quite well. And frankly, they do well. Rejection rates are below 15%. I think this is because early on, patients do great. But long term, there are still issues. And this is a recent study on long-term survival. And so here we're comparing, we're looking at standard criteria donor, deceased donors, and living and patients who receive kidneys from living donors. And these are the cumulative graft failure yearly attrition rate. So in yellow, this shows the 1 year attrition rate starting in 1989 to 2009. The reason why it starts in 1989, because that year ends the introduction of all the new agents from the 1990s. Tacrolimus, MMF, sirolimus, the IL-2 antibodies, thymoglobulin. And we did we see a marked reduction in acute rejection. And in fact, the 1 year attrition rate has decreased substantially. Now, when you go to 1 to 3 years, you can see that it's starting to flatten. If you go to the 3 to 5, and this is in green here, it's rather flat. And 5 to 10, the yearly attrition rate hasn't changed. In recipients of living donors, same thing, marked decrease in the attrition rate year after year for 1 year. But as you go to 1 to 3 years, 3 to 5, 5 to 10, you can see that it's totally flat. So I think we do great early on, but I'm not so sure we are doing as well long term. And I think the major impetus towards developing newer drugs is not to improve the early results. You're not going to lower acute rejection rate, I can assure you. You're not going to change the early outcomes. I mean, the outcome 1 year, very good. The issue is, one, can you improve renal function? Can you maintain renal function? Can you decrease cardiovascular risk factors? And, you know, the CNI have a lot of hidden CNS type of symptoms that sometimes patients don't realize. Recently, I switched a patient from CNI to belatacept. A few days later, she woke up. It was the first time she tasted food good. And so we tend not to associate many of these neurologic subtle side effects of the CNI. But in fact, I think it does long-term impair the quality of life. And finally, I want to show an issue about the rejection rate. And this is a study based on 300-plus patients. This is almost the same group as the, not essentially the same, as the DCAF studies, where here both histologic analysis as well as molecular tools were utilized to differentiate between the various rejection rates. And what we have found, this researcher, is that if you have a T-cell mediated rejection early on as compared to no rejection, the outcome is not significantly different. So many of these rejections that we have decreased with the very potent agents of the 1990s have never affected outcome. And that's why in many series we have not seen a relationship between long-term outcome and lowering acute rejection. We have seen it with one-year graft survival because we also concomitantly have lowered bad rejection, the antibody-mediated rejection and the more severe rejection. We've lowered those. But your average T-cell-mediated early rejection, early cell rejection, does not have a major impact on graft outcome. And so my point is the following, that the primary endpoint of all new studies for the FDA has always been acute rejection. The GFR is bad, they don't care. Cardiovascular risk factors are high, they may not care. I think it's an exaggeration to say that they don't care. But there has been a great emphasis placed on acute rejection at the expense of everything else. What I'm suggesting is that there has to be a better balance. Renal function may be the better endpoint. I mean, do you care if you had a rejection, if your GFR is at 70 after 1 year and it remains at 70 at 2 and 3 and 4 years? Because if your GFR is high and your slope is good, is either positive or stable, you're going to lose the graft only if you die or something other happens. And so I think we really, as a transplant community, but even people involved with clinical trials and the FDA, you know, we have to rebalance the importance of each of these endpoints. And I think this is going to be a challenge going forward with all the newer agents. We may have to accept slightly higher risk at the beginning for a better outcome long term. So in conclusion, belatacept immunosuppression represents novelty in ways that will be challenging to transplant physicians. But belatacept could emerge as a transformational agent if it proves it can be administered effectively and safely in a wider use. Thank you, and be happy to answer your questions.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.